Well, hey, y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Today on the show, Andy Worthington is going to be here to talk about Guantanamo Bay. I don't know if you saw, but the president just gave a speech all about foreign policy. Honestly, didn't watch all of it. And I didn't pay that close of attention to the part I did watch. I was doing other stuff. I got the transcript here. But one of the things I heard him say was, oh yeah, you know, man, I really think that it's un-American and against our values to hold people without trial. And that's why I'm against keeping Guantanamo Bay open. That's why I insist we close it. He was actually on a whole riff about American exceptionalism means obey international law. I don't know what he was talking about, but he was trying to pretend that he thought that the law should bind the activities of the government and its agents just like everybody else. Isn't that hilarious? And then he cried, boo-hoo, I would like to close Guantanamo Bay. Well, what's he ever done to close Guantanamo Bay? Nothing. He could have closed Guantanamo Bay with the stroke of his pen on January 20th, 2009. And there's nothing that the Republicans in Congress can do to stop it. They can pass a law saying they refuse to finance it. It doesn't matter. There's plenty of money in the Pentagon pipeline. They are his troops, each and every one of them. Every officer and every soldier there. He is their commander in chief. He can order them to move. And they have no choice but to do what he says. So in his speech today, never even mind on paper, if in his speech the president had just said, that's it, Guantanamo, pack it up and start sailing back to Miami. The Republicans will figure out what to do with the rest of the prisoners when you get here. Won't you, Republicans? But each and every one of you generals and admirals and captains and lieutenants and whatever, pack up your stuff. That's it. Guantanamo Bay Prison is hereby closed by order of the Emperor of the planet Earth. He can start a war in Libya on his own say-so. He can sure as hell close Guantanamo Prison. I am so sick of Barack Obama. What a lousy bastard. I mean, I know it's hard. After Bush and Cheney, even McCain would have been a breath of fresh air, a sigh of relief or something there, but I am just so sick and tired of this Barack Obama. He's just horrible on everything. And everything that he pretends to be good on, he's only pretending. That drives me to absolute frustration. And there are all kinds of things he said in that speech that made me mad, but that was the first one. And so I got Andy Worthington coming on to discuss it. And man, I've had the hardest time getting a hold of everybody else today. I've gotten a couple of no's, but mostly a bunch of no answers is, unfortunately. I guess people are out and about and doing other things and not near their email today, and that sucks. But Will Grigg is going to be on the show tomorrow. Got plenty to talk with him about. And then Brendan O'Neill, he had to cancel on me today. We were going to talk about all of the right-wing and populist groups that did so well in the European Union parliamentary elections the other day. All across Europe. But now he's come down sick. That's Brendan O'Neill from Spiked Online. So we're going to catch up with him on Friday. In other words, I get a great show lined up for you the rest of the week. Today, though, I got Andy Worthington. That should be good. And the hour is still young, so we still might hear back from some others. And it's all right, because we still have plenty of news to cover. And we got a telephone here if you guys want to call in the show. So that'll be good, too. Join up the chat room. New guy just joined up the chat room and said, test. Hey there. ScottHorton.org/chat. Now, it used to be, I think, that you needed a Chatzilla or XChat or Pigeon or some kind of thing in order to join up the chat room, but you don't. You can have those. It's IRC free node chat room, but if you want to just go to ScottHorton.org/chat, all you need is a plain old internet browser. Exploder or Firefox or Opera or Chrome or Safari or whatever. Yeah, just go to scotthorton.org/chat, put in a fake name and the CAPTCHA, and blam, you're in. Join up the chat room and say hi to the folks. Been having a pretty good number of people in there the last few days. We're starting off a little slow today, but we'll see how it goes. I think part of the problem is I didn't give enough advance notice to everyone that I was changing the time of the show. So I probably have quite a few people wondering what the hell happened. Where's Scott from 3 to 5? They are wondering. Well, here I am. And by the way, if you ever can't find me, scotthorton.org, you can find me there. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow, you can find me there too. But yeah, sometimes I have to move from network to network. Oh, rats. Wow, that's nice. Well, Nancy Youssef just said that she's afraid that she can't do the show because she is so tied up, but she says she is a huge fan of the show and always loved being part of it. Are you kidding me? Why, my cheeks are all rosy red now with blushing and embarrassment and that kind of stuff. Nancy Youssef listens to this show? Man, I better ratchet up the caliber big time and quickly. Nancy Youssef, why, she's one of the greatest journalists on the planet Earth. Now, of course, I love her work, and I want to interview her all the time. Just like Landay and Prothero and a lot of the people at McClatchy who do such great work. But she listens to me? Uh-oh. I better get better. You know, I thought it was just you guys out there, but now I know that you guys includes Nancy Youssef. Wow. She's great, by the way. And if, for that matter, McClatchy Newspapers, that's my favorite newspaper chain. They bought out Knight Ridder and brought the best of Knight Ridder on. I don't remember now if Nancy had been a Knight Ridder reporter or not. Landay and Strobel. Oh, I guess Strobel went off some other place. But they brought in Landay. I think they brought in Strobel for a while. And then he went off to write for somebody else. But anyway, Nancy Youssef and Jonathan Landay, Mitchell Prothero, even Roy Guttman. And Roy, yeah, you know, he gets some things wrong sometimes, but I like him, man. He's done a lot of really great work. For example, on American and Saudi support for the dictatorship in Bahrain, Roy has done a lot of really great work, and so he's not always perfect, but I like Roy too. And back when David Enders was there, I mean, you guys know this, right? We talked about this. David Enders was literally kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front, bin Ladenite suicide bomber terrorists in Syria, and then they let him go. He lived to tell the tale of being captured by al-Nusra. And he did a lot of great reporting out of there for a long time, although I think he's changed his beat and is doing a little bit different work now. He's still a journalist, but he's not doing the war from on the ground in Syria anymore. Thank goodness. You know, I would rather have David survive and suffer without his journalism, if it's up to me. But anyway, so I really like those guys. They do a lot of great work, and Nancy Youssef has been really great too. So I'm flattered. She listens to my show. I think I've only interviewed her once or twice, but anyway, that sure is nice. Okay. All right, so now I got so many damn things to complain about too, and I don't know exactly which order I should go in, but I guess I should start with Obama's speech here. First of all, let me just pounce on this ridiculous red herring. American isolationism is not an example, the president says. But, you know, here's the thing about it. There are no isolationists in America. There aren't any. You know, if you look at, say, for example, Daniel Larrison and Pat Buchanan and the guys at the American Conservative magazine, they're the paleocons. They are the anti-war conservatives, but they're for some trade. And they're certainly for, you know, open diplomacy and engagement with the world. They're just anti-war. And it's true, they are protectionists. That's the reason I invoke them. You know, they are not for free trade. And that makes them not libertarians, that makes them conservatives. Well, that's one of the things that makes them conservatives. But they're not isolationists. Now, libertarians, of course, just like in the Pew poll, we reflect the same point of view as the American people at large. We are for all engagement, private and voluntary, open engagement, exchange, and trade. We're just anti-war and anti-empire. Same thing for liberals who are even like pro-union anti-trade types. They're still not isolationists, so that's purely a red herring. Hey y'all, Scott here. Some stock market investors are making money hand over fist, while others sit on the sidelines afraid of the dangers. Are you looking for answers? Before you invest $1, I'd like you to take the time to watch this new video from Martin Weiss at moneyandmarkets.com. The video names the 7 riskiest and 4 safest major stocks in America. Learn from the experts and invest wisely. Go to crisis16.com. That's crisis16.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the goddamn thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm at scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now going back to 2003. scotthorton.org. Here noon to 3 Eastern Time on the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM and affiliates and etc. Like I say, Andy Worthington will be joining us a little bit later. I'm going to be talking a little bit about libertarianism today, although probably not that much. But also cops, guns, Syria, a few other things coming up. And yeah, I still might hear back from a couple of the invitees that I haven't heard back from yet. Andy coming up here in just a little while. So don't go anywhere. All right. Back to Obama here and Obama's big foreign policy speech today. And I admit I was not a rapt attention. I was quite distracted at the time working on other things. And, you know, I really have a hard time listening to Barack Obama, honestly. If I have a chance later, I'll probably sit and read the whole thing. But, his voice really, you know, annoys me in the way that, you know, like Sarah Palin, where it's like somebody poking my eardrum with a needle or something. I would rather bash my own head in with a bat than listen to one word out of her mouth. I just can't stand it. With Obama, it's not like that. With Obama, it's more just, huh? What? How much horse crap can you shovel in a row and expect me to continue paying attention? I mean, all the excuses and spin and rationalizations and crap that he builds into all of his sentences. He's got to tell me 15 lies in one sentence before he can even get to his damned point. I just can't take it. It's like rereading the same essay that I wrote again and again and again for errors. I just can't do it. My brain just doesn't work that way. I already wrote the damn thing. I reread it once, maybe twice, but that's it. I'm looking at the paragraph, but I'm not reading it. I cannot keep reading the same thing I already wrote over and over again. I can't. I need somebody else to do it. I can't do it. It's the same thing with listening to the President of the United States. I can't listen to him. Anyway, so here, they published the damn thing at the Washington Post, assuming it's accurate. American isolationism is not an option. Now, this ought to, and I don't mean to be, you know, patronizing and insulting for everybody who already gets this, you know, but it's a point worth making, that if you were to take that smear and apply it to any other group of peaceniks in any other country, you would see immediately how it falls apart, right? Does the American political class constantly accuse the Brazilian government and the Brazilian population of being isolationists for refusing to go to war all the time? That wouldn't make any sense. They didn't join us on invading Iraq, but that doesn't quite make them isolationists, does it? Or how about, any of the freeloading NATO countries that just sit around, even where they're, you know, supposedly the international, NATO army in Afghanistan, the Americans do all the fighting. Everybody else, remember Michael Hastings said that they called the International Task Force, the acronym spelled out, in sandals and flip-flops, or I suck at fighting. ISAF, ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force, I suck at fighting. The Americans do all their fighting for them. Does that make them isolationists? The Australians, who have they invaded lately? Oh, I guess Afghanistan. That's a bad example. Anyway, the Canadians, they sat out Vietnam. Did that make them isolationists? they sat out Iraq, did that make them isolationists? Or that just meant, hey, here was a war that they didn't want to start? Well, how about the Vietnamese? The Vietnamese haven't come with us to invade Iraq or Afghanistan. Are they isolationists? Or they're just not an imperial power? They're a domestic tyranny only. They're in communist Vietnam. And what would it mean for Americans to be isolationists? If that word has a definition, it would mean that they favor a policy of no trade with the world, of no recognition with the rest of the world, no diplomats, no negotiations, ultimate protectionism for American markets, which is counterproductive, but, you know, presumably an isolationist wouldn't understand that. And the fact is, there are none. I mean, you can find a hermit living in his house or whatever who's a personal isolationist, but in terms of even unorganized political movements in America, there are no isolationists, right? There are not any. The anti-WTO, pro-labor union liberals, they're not isolationists. They are protectionists. And, you know, sometimes you can even hear them saying some kind of racist sounding stuff about the Chinese and stuff. But are they really isolationists? They want to shut down all trade and all, you know, foreign internationalism, if not interventionism, and probably half of them are pro-interventionists when Democrats are in power. But take, for example, the honest ones, Seattle 99 kids who let's pretend that we believe that all of them have stayed anti-war this whole time, even after the election of Barack Obama. That still doesn't make them isolationists. I already talked about how, you know, clearly the paleo conservatives are not isolationists. In fact, Fitzy G said in the chat room that Pat was talking about going ahead and sending the special forces to rescue the missing Nigerian girls now on the McLaughlin group last Sunday morning. So that doesn't, he's not even an anti-imperialist anymore. He's not even an anti-interventionist anymore. You know, Pat's always wishy-washy, especially on TV. He's worse on TV. His writing is usually great, but, I mean, on foreign policy stuff. But anyway, there are no isolationists. And so, what a ridiculous straw man. Of course, the only reason that Barack Obama brings it up is to knock it down, because he cannot take on the anti-interventionists head-on and win. He has to lie. And check out his next sentence. Talk about non sequiturs. He says, American isolationism is not an option. Nuclear materials are not secure. That could pose a danger in American cities. Well, wait a minute. What are you talking about? This is in the middle of a discussion about Syria. Well, he's kind of lumping a bunch of things together. But he just throws in there loose nuclear materials. Well, what nuclear materials? The only loose nuclear materials anyone in the world is worried about are in Russia. And if anything is preventing the U.S. government from being able to buy up excess weapons-grade plutonium from the Russians, it's Obama's anti-Russian, pro-NATO expansion, pro-Nazi coup d'etat in Ukraine, pro-missiles in Poland foreign policy. This guy who was the student of Dick Lugar, who wrote the Nunn-Lugar Act to say, let's buy up all of Russia's old nuclear material. And then he calls me an isolationist for opposing his wars and his provocations that have driven such a wedge between the U.S. and Russia on issues like this. I've not yet begun to complain about this speech. You just wait. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you can hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples, and email me, scott@scotthorton.org, for more information. See you there. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And our first guest up on the show today is our good friend Andy Worthington. He's the author of the book, The Guantanamo Files, and also directed the movie, the documentary film, Outside the Law. He keeps a website at andyworthington.com. Co.uk, and he is, well, and there's some competition here, but he is, I think, pretty much beyond dispute, the world's foremost expert and chronicler of the perpetual American war crime down at the, well, collection of war crimes down there at the American prison at Guantanamo Bay in communist Cuba. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I'm good, Scott. How are you?
Good, good. And you sound great, too.
Yeah, good. Yeah, the Skype thing is working, I think.
Yeah, I always had the worst problems with it, so I became a very, you know, very Luddite about it and just decided to stick with the phone, but finally got somebody to help me figure out how to get it working right, and so now I'm using it as much as I can because it sounds pretty damn good.
Yeah, cool.
I think my problem was I started trying to use it when it first came out 10 years ago or something, and it wasn't ready for prime time yet, and then I didn't go back to try to make it work.
Yeah.
Anyway. Let's talk about Guantanamo Bay. A stupid president gave a talk today at West Point, and it's so funny. He says, I believe in American exceptionalism with every fiber of our being. But then he says, what makes us exceptional is our willingness to affirm international law. I don't even know what in the hell. I don't think he even has any idea what in the hell he's talking about. But then, speaking of non sequiturs, here comes the next one. Quote, that's why I will continue to push to close Gitmo, because American values and legal traditions don't permit the indefinite detention of people beyond our borders. So my question for you, Andy, is how long has this guy been in office now as commander-in-chief of every branch of the U.S. military?
Well, you know, far too long, really, to be demonstrating this kind of inability to understand that he has the power to do things, and you know, and he's still choosing not to do them. It's very strange, that comment, isn't it, about American values and legal traditions don't permit the indefinite detention of people beyond our borders. Does that mean that he's suggesting that within the borders, American values and legal traditions do permit the indefinite detention of people?
Right.
It's, I don't think
well,
that's what
he's the one who signed the NDAA Act into law on New Year's Eve when everybody was out getting drunk, right?
Yeah, maybe that's just reminding people of the NDAA. Yeah, no, that's
what exceptionalism means. No charges for you.
Well, you know, I mean, I have to say, Scott, that he's done, you know, he's done the same thing. And actually, you know, we're going to talk about it soon, but it's, you know, it's almost a year, just over a year since he made a promise to resume releasing prisoners from Guantanamo. You know, every time he speaks about it, he sounds great, but his actions never match his words.
Mm-hmm.
And so here again, really, is what he's, you know, he's saying, you know, very briefly, some of the things that are wrong with Guantanamo, even if he seems to be slightly confused this time around about exactly what he means. But, you know, he's saying, you know, I will continue to push to close Guantanamo, as though he's some kind of opposition politician pressurizing the president of the United States to do something. And, you know, he is the president of the United States. And there are certainly lawmakers who would have a go at him if he really pushed for the closure of Guantanamo and did the things that he's able to do, but he's choosing not to. You know, up until recently, there'd been more or less 3 years of opposition from Congress to try and make it very difficult for him to release prisoners from Guantanamo. And obviously, you know, politically, when he's up against Congress being in such a bullish mood, he was going to have to be up for a fight, but he presented it to the public that Congress had totally tied his hands.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he always had a waiver in the legislation, which, you know, Senator Carl Levin, the head of the powerful Senate Armed Services Committee, had insisted on having in the legislation, that allowed him to overcome these congressional obstacles and bypass Congress if he regarded the release of prisoners as being in the national security interest of the United States. And as we see, every time he talks about Guantanamo, closing the place is in the national security interest of the United States. So, you know, we've got this kind of disconnect. And
right. So wait
here
a minute,
we are.
Let me make sure I understand you right here, Andy, because so it's not that Congress has said, well, I guess I'm confused maybe. It seems like two different issues here. Whether he can close the base and move all the prisoners out of there, or whether he can let this one go at any given time. But you're telling me it's just one thing that Congress has done, and it applies to both cases, and the president has every authority under that law to issue a waiver. So if he wanted to send some Yemenis back to Yemen or some Uyghurs back to wherever, whoever's going to let them in, I guess they already took care of that. He can do that. He cannot just waive the restrictions on individual prisoners, but on the whole island prison. Is that correct?
Well, no, it's not, actually. I'm sorry if I was unclear there, Scott. He can't actually... well, it's much more difficult for him to actually close the prison. He doesn't have legislation that allows him to do that. There is no waiver in the NDAA that allows him to do that. But he, as the president of the United States, he could do something exceptional. He could issue an executive order and move all the men from Guantanamo to the U.S. mainland.
Well, his original plan was to bring Gitmo Justice to American shores as well, and to go ahead and say, yeah, no, we still mean to hold these men without trial. If we think they're guilty, but we know we can't prove it, we don't care. We'll hold them without charges or trial forever, but we should just do it in Illinois instead of in communist Cuba.
Scott, I mean, I don't actually believe that. I mean, I actually think that if you move the men from Guantanamo to the United States mainland, you would suddenly find that there are a lot more reasons why courts would be saying, sorry, we don't actually have a tradition of holding people indefinitely without charge or trial on the United States mainland.
Well, that was the original scam of putting it in Cuba in the first place, was that the U.S. law can't reach us here. And the first time the Supreme Court heard a case like that, they said, no, you're wrong.
Exactly. But, you know, the Congress continues to block him from closing the facility at Guantanamo by bringing men to the United States mainland for whatever reason, mm-hmm. to continue to be held indefinitely, to be put on trial, whatever.
Although, couldn't he just completely ignore that? I mean, he's Mr. Signing Statement, no less than George W. Bush.
Well,
he can start a war in Libya. Can't he just order the military men at Guantanamo, close the prison, bring the men here? Don't worry, Congress will figure out what to tell you to do with the prisoners by the time you arrive in Miami. But I'm telling you, move, soldier, move. He's the commander-in-chief.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying, Scott. And, you know, and I think that, you know, the pressure is going to be on him from those of us who care about this, you know, more and more as his presidency wanes. But the main issue at the moment is that half the men in Guantanamo are men that his administration, you know, that a task force and review boards set up by him, high-level people, have said, you know, half the guys at Guantanamo, 77 of the remaining 154 men are people that we do not want to carry on holding indefinitely. We don't want to put them on trial. And it's those people who he has the ability to do something about. Every moment that we talk about it, he has the ability to do something about it, regardless of whether or not Congress is particularly supportive. And it must be said that Congress was persuaded through the entreaties of high-level people like Senator Carl Levin at the end of last year to ease their restrictions on the release of prisoners. There has never been a better time in the last 3 years for President Obama to release men from Guantanamo than this moment in time. But since he promised to resume releasing prisoners 1 year ago, 1 year and 5 days ago, when he was responding to the outrage that had been felt internationally about the prison-wide hunger strike and the men's despair. And he promised to resume releasing prisoners. He appointed 2 envoys to help. And we have had 12 men released in the last year. Now, don't get me wrong, you know, I'm very glad to see those 12 men released. But 77 of the remaining men are still waiting to be freed. And the majority of those men were told in January 2010 that the task force that President Obama had set up, high-level task force, had looked at their cases, that the U.S. wasn't interested in holding them forever or putting them on trial.
And all right, I'm sorry, we got to hold it right there, Andy, and go out and take this break. Can you hear the music?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll be right back after this, everybody, with the great Andy Worthington, andyworthington.co.uk. And buy his book. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with the heroic Andy Worthington, andyworthington.co.uk. The book is Guantanamo Files. The movie is Outside the Law. You can find his writings also at the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org. And let's see, before the break there, we were talking about how many of these men have already been cleared for release and are still being held anyway. And now, so you said it was about half, Andy. 77 out of 154 or something like that already cleared. Now, what about the rest? Because as far as, well, I mean, I'm not, you know, completely familiar with each and every one of these guys, but it makes sense to me that when they finally closed at least some of the CIA black sites and they brought Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib and a couple of other of these extremely guilty 9/11 conspirators to Guantanamo, that you know, it made sense that they would be held, what, somewhere that they were actually, you know, deserved to be held under some circumstances or another. But that, if anything, it really just went to show how innocent everybody else there was. But so now when you're telling me it's about half and half, I wonder about that, because it seemed like, you know, the really guilty, the real friends of bin Laden that they grabbed were only, what, a dozen, maybe two?
Yeah, well, you know, and possibly less than that. I mean, the thing is, Scott, of the other 77 men, the majority of those men have been put forward for what are called periodic review boards. So these are men who, when the task force that President Obama established when he took office for the first time in 2009, when they looked at the cases of all the prisoners, they designated them for prosecution, for release, or for ongoing imprisonment without charge or trial. That last one was the really, really dodgy one, where they said, you know, these guys, we think they're too dangerous to release, but we haven't got the evidence to actually put them on trial. So that means there are fundamental problems with the evidence. But anyway, what happened was that President Obama issued an executive order approving the ongoing imprisonment of these men. It was 48 of them. Two of them subsequently died. So 46 men. He personally said, I'm going to go with what the task force told me. These guys are too dangerous to release, but we haven't got the evidence to put them on trial. So I'm going to sign this executive order and we're going to hold them. What we're going to do is we're going to give them periodic reviews to see whether we think that they're still too dangerous to release on an ongoing basis. Those took nearly 3 years to establish, and last year they finally began to take place in the fall. There's only been a handful of them so far, but almost all of the other men that are still held are supposed to get these periodic reviews, not just the ones designated for indefinite detention by the task force, but the majority of those who were designated for prosecution by the task force, because guess what? The prosecutions at Guantanamo in the military commission system, the appeals court recently told the government that they're invented war crimes and that they're not allowed to do that. Mm-hmm. They actually dismissed two of the only convictions that they ever achieved. Can you believe this? You know, Congress invented war crimes that they inserted into the Military Commissions Act, and the courts eventually had to turn around and say,
"Oh hell yeah!" What I can't believe is that the courts ever made them stop. I mean, we talked for years about how ridiculous it was that these war criminals, who, you know, for example, are torturing children, are then charging the children that they tortured and held for years without charges of war crimes. You know, come on, pot kettle black. I mean, it's not even that, right? It's like, you know, Cotter, he was, the worst thing he was guilty of is the non-crime of self-defense against foreign invaders. And you know, the rest of this material support this and that. I'm amazed that a judge said, no, you can't do that. Actually, the law is a thing written on a piece of paper, not your will being exercised however you feel like. Whoever heard of that in the 21st century?
And so, you know, so what we've got is that, you know, we've got these review boards that have started recently, and they've actually approved two men, two Yemenis for release. So they're added to the list of all the cleared prisoners waiting to go. But if you look at how many people are facing these reviews and how many people are cleared for release, then who are the people who are not, you know, who are not included? Who are the people who are so genuinely bad, allegedly, that there is no system in place that's going to lead to their release and that they're going to be put on trial? It actually is the six men who are currently charged, and it's two other guys who have taken plea deals. And it's one other guy who's serving a sentence that he was given under the Bush administration, even though his is one of the convictions that was overturned by the appeals court. That's it. That's actually nine of the people left in Guantanamo. Nine of the 154 guys are people who categorically the U.S. government has said, you know, there's no way that these people are going to go through any kind of review process and be told that they will be released. What can I say, Scott? Is this what we're left with? I mean, the periodic reviews have already judged the cases of three men. And as I said, two of them were cleared for release. In the third case, the review board, which is, you know, high-ranking people in various government departments and the intelligence agencies, decided that the man should still be held. It's pretty disgraceful, really. There isn't actual evidence against him demonstrating that he remains a threat to the United States. But you know, as I know, that you know that common sense and a sense of proportion have never been things that have taken place at Guantanamo. So they're going to go through these periodic reviews, and they're going to, you know, maybe one out of every three, they're going to say, no, we have to keep holding these guys. But the number of people that they're claiming the ability to hold for any reason, because they're actually a significant threat of any kind, is a dwindling figure. And I really wish that we could somehow get this message out to the American people. But I honestly think that, you know, most people still aren't aware of quite what a disgraceful failure of intelligence, an abject exercise of cruelty Guantanamo has been for the last 12 years.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm confused, too, because who cares if they don't have any evidence? They can convict anyone they want of anything they want in federal court.
Yeah.
Accuse them of mail fraud or something. Put them away for life without parole. I don't think that the federal prosecutors have ever lost a case in federal court. Federal jury will put anyone in prison for as long as they're told to, with, you know, 0.00000001% exceptions, and never in the case of a terrorism case is a jury going to nullify and say hell no and set someone free. They never have, certainly not in the 21st century they haven't. They could convict any of these guys of anything just by pointing at them and saying to the jury, first of all, just look at them. You can tell that he believes in this Allah crap. Come on, give him life.
Up to a point, Scott, but I think the problem is that, you know, what they've actually got in Guantanamo for the most part, you know, beyond the innocent people who were absolutely nothing to do with anything, and, you know, many of those have been released, but there are still some there. But what they've largely got in Guantanamo now are people who were demonstrably involved with the Taliban to some extent, either as foot soldiers or in some notorious cases as chefs. But, you know, these were people who were captured in a military context. So what we should be talking about is, like, you know, are we really going to hold people forever in this military context? Or does the point come where we should let them go? These are not people that if you put them in federal court, you've actually got any kind of crime. It's like, what, the most you've ever got against this guy is that he went to a training camp.
Yeah, they're POWs, basically, only they're irregulars. So they're outside the law.
There, yeah? Sorry, Scott, yeah?
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just saying, basically, they're POWs. They're not even accused criminals. They're POWs, but because they were irregulars, you know, supposedly under the Doug Fight theory, Geneva doesn't apply, POW rules don't apply, so they just hold them in this, you know, legal black hole.
Well, that's what I think. I think they are essentially misplaced prisoners of war, and that was a deliberate mistake on the part of the Bush administration. And, you know, and that's what upsets me when you read the kind of knee-jerk responses to any discussion of, about Guantanamo from people on the right who you know, just call them terrorists. You know, they were sold that message by Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld and George W. Bush, but they have swallowed it, and nobody has sufficiently challenged them in all these years to say most of these guys never had anything to do with terrorism.
Right. Well, and let me go ahead and ask you now, is there any way I could keep you past the top of the hour and do one more segment in the next hour?
Yeah, how long? Yeah, sure.
Okay, good, because I got more questions, and we're almost out of time for this segment. But I wanted to bring up here real quick, since we're talking about the prosecutions and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and all them have come up, that, and this is a point that the other Scott Horton, the international human rights lawyer, has made on this show for, 9 years now, or something like that, is that we already have laws. And we have 200 and something years worth of experience of putting people in prison for whatever, we being the U.S. government in this case. And what Addington and Bush and then later Congress, after the Supreme Court said you had to include Congress, what they did with this ad hoc thing is they created a mess, and they don't know how to control it, and they're making it up as they go along, and that's why it never works, and that's why Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is now allowed to show up in court in a camouflage hunting jacket, as though he is some kind of general in Al-Qaeda's army, rather than the lowest scum of the earth two-bit criminal, which would never be allowed in federal court, but... That's because of how illegal the whole process is. Now, I'm sorry, we're out of time, but I'll let you comment on that if you want, and we'll be back at 6 after. It's Andy Worthington, everybody. The book is The Guantanamo Files. Hey, Al Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the dang thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Hey, let's do business. You own a business? Or a political group or something? Advertise on the show. I'm Scott at scotthorton.org. Let's work something out. I'm in a capitalistic mood right now, yeah. All right, I'm on the line with the great Andy Worthington, the heroic Andy Worthington. He's at the Future Freedom Foundation, FFF.org, also at andyworthington.co.uk. The book is The Guantanamo Files, really biographies or, you know, as much as could be known at the time anyway, about each and every one of the detainees there at Guantanamo Bay, and then plus the documentary film Outside the Law. So thank you again very much for joining us and for holding through that long top of the hour break there, Andy. Because I still had a couple of questions for you here. Oh, I guess, but before we went out to break, I was on my little rant there about what a disaster the actual trials are and the process of the trials for those who actually are even getting them. And pardon me, because trials should go in ironic quotes there. I meant to say it in an italicized sort of tone of voice there. The ones of them who are getting trials... their trials seem to be a total joke to me because it's all made up ad hoc crap. What do you think?
Well, I think the main problem is that these men were tortured, and torture is inadmissible in U.S. courts. So the problem is that the prosecution is constantly trying to suppress all mention of the fact that these men were held for years in black sites run by the CIA and subjected to torture. And in fact, you can't have anything resembling a fair trial without raising these issues in the first place. My feeling, Scott, has always been that if these cases were transferred to federal court, then so long as they could come up with something that resembled evidence, an average American jury would overlook all of these issues and would convict them if anything resembling evidence was provided.
Well, and look, I mean, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Ramzi bin al-Shib both bragged to Al Jazeera that they're guilty before they were ever captured. So question about who Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is here, regardless of what he said under torture. I know he took responsibility for every criminal act since Hitler's suicide under torture.
No, I think so. But, you know, but I'm wondering whether we're ever going to get to this point, Scott, where, you know, where these trials are going to go ahead. You know, I mean, that's what I think. I think that the Obama administration said they were going to try these men in federal court in New York City. And then back down when they got criticized, which made Eric Holder look really stupid. But I think also, you know, was the disemboweling of what remained of the law in the Guantanamo years, that they didn't go ahead with the only way that they could have done it. These pretrial hearings are going to drag on and on and on and on endlessly at Guantanamo, I think. And essentially what's happening is that these men are being held indefinitely and may continue to be held indefinitely for the rest of their lives without the trial ever actually taking place. So I would think at some point it would make sense to move them back to New York as they wanted to do, have these trials in the best way possible, and when mention of torture comes up, to use that as an excuse, as an opportunity for saying, we know how tainted these cases are, but we have evidence that has come from other sources to demonstrate that what we're saying is true in the case of these people. And we promise in front of the world that we will never, ever go back to the dark side, as Dick Cheney insisted we had to do after the 9/11 attacks. We will not torture. That's what I'd like to see happen, Scott. But
well, you know, I think it's
miles away from that.
It's a pretty common principle, but is there anything in Anglo-American law that actually says if you were tortured, then you've done your time and you're free to go now? I mean, it would be horrible to see Khalid Sheikh Mohammed released, but then again, they shouldn't have tortured him.
Well, no, and I don't know of anything that, you know, to suggest that, but I don't think...
That just seems like fair, you know, kind of practice, right? If they tortured you, then you're free to go, man. You've done your
time.
Well,
you know, I think that if the things that he is supposed to have done, he did do... Then I can't see anyone actually suggesting that he should go free.
Except me.
Now, I think the default position, the one that the Bush administration established after 9/11, is hey, let's tear up all the rule books and then imprison a load of people. And you know, and they didn't care whether any of these people were ever going to be released. We have the problem at Guantanamo that the place is stuffed full of nobodies who can't get released.
Right.
You know, it's the prison without end. So the Bush administration has set up the kind of perfect system for holding people without rights for the rest of their lives. And the default position for Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the rest of those guys is that whether the trials go ahead or not, they are staying there forever and will not be released. You know, the question is whether after the fact some American government or other can come up with a structure that will enable them to go through a process to justify it. I don't know whether that's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, so can you tell me this? How many people are on hunger strike right now? I know they quit covering it.
They quit covering it, and what we have is the terrible stories that are coming out from the prisoners themselves, including, you know, this Syrian man, Abu Wail Diab, who's been cleared for release, like many of the hunger strikers. Why is he hunger striking? Because he was told 4 years ago that the U.S. didn't want to hold him anymore and that he'd be going home soon. Or if not home to Syria, then the U.S. would find another country for him. But he's still stuck there. And he's been on a hunger strike. He recently won a court case where he persuaded a federal court judge to put a stay on his force feeding. That didn't last. That stay has been dropped. But she did insist that the United States government provided videotaped evidence of him being force-fed and of him being violently moved to be force-fed when he didn't want to leave his cell. This is certainly something of a breakthrough, and I hope that it's putting pressure on the administration because, you know, here is a man who's being force-fed, who, you know, he's actually been offered a new home by President Mujica of Uruguay. He is offered to take 6 men who can't be safely repatriated. And Mr. Diab is one of them. So as far as I can see, President Obama could put this man and 5 others on a plane and send them to Uruguay tomorrow. And I don't know why he doesn't do that.
And by the way, for people not familiar, it isn't like Uruguay is some rogue state out there. They're perfectly compliant and would do everything up to American specifications for keeping an eye on these guys or whatever, whatever.
Well, I mean, actually, he said, no, we're not going to subject them to any kind of, you know, obsessive scrutiny because we want them to have a new life, which I think is the fair thing to say, because the problem with Guantanamo.
Well, that's why Obama's not releasing them then.
Well, you know, yeah, he doesn't want to have to go through that problem of having to tell Congress, look, these guys are not a threat to anybody. That's why we decided that we're prepared to release them. So I don't know. But, you know, he's one of this guy, Mr. Diab, is one of the hunger strikers. He's certainly not the only one who hasn't been cleared for release, who has been cleared for release but is still held, who is being force-fed. The numbers, as you say, Scott, are difficult to know exactly because the military stopped reporting them in December because it was attracting too much attention for the prisoners. But
right. From
what I understand, it's probably up to a couple of dozen of the men are on a hunger strike and being force-fed.
All right, and now I read a thing, last question here. I read a thing last week, I guess, that said that they had this new trick going on in the Congress. You know how they do where nobody wants to vote for a pay raise, and no congressman does. So what they do is they make the pay raise automatic unless they vote against it, right?
Right.
And so they never do. Well, they passed a thing that would basically make closing Guantanamo automatic unless they pass a new thing stopping it. And that was supposedly, you know, maybe a way that Obama had figured out to get Congress to go along with this thing and give them a safe out so that these Republicans can tell their idiot Republican constituents back home that I tried to stop them without really trying to stop them. What do you think of that? Is that true?
Well, I mean, certainly, what, you know, again, this is Senator Carl Levin. I think I have the utmost respect for the way that Senator Carl Levin genuinely has accepted that Guantanamo is a stain on any claim that America might try to make to be a country that respects the rule of law. And, you know, he's certainly been pushing more than the administration has, as far as I can see, to try and bring an end to it. Now, what needs to happen is that parts of Congress need to be persuaded that their absolute ban on bringing prisoners to the U.S. mainland for any reason is dropped. And last year, part of the deal that was made in Congress was that Republican lawmakers, for the most part, would ease their restrictions on the release of prisoners. But in exchange, they insisted that the absolute ban on bringing prisoners to the U.S. mainland for any reason was maintained in the legislation. I can't see that they're going to want to give up on that, and that they will find their way around this nice little trick, and will, you know, yet again put this into the NDAA to try and make sure that Guantanamo stays open. But we'll see, Scott. You know, I mean, what we're really, again, waiting for is much more of a demonstration of leadership from the one man who is supposed to have the ability to deal with these things, which is the President of the United States.
Right. All right. Well, we're over time. I might as well go ahead and ask you then. Could you hear the music just now or not?
No, I couldn't.
Oh, you could not hear. All right. I got to turn this thing up, man. I got it. All right. Well, anyway, thank you very much for your time, as always. It's great talking to you, especially for staying over with us here.
Yeah, well, that's been great to talk for all this time, Scott. Thank you very much.
I sure appreciate having you. That's the great Andy Worthington, everybody. He's at andyworthington.co.uk at the Future Freedom Foundation. That's fff.org. And get his book, The Guantanamo Files, and his movie, Outside the Law. And we'll be right back. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. Who, me, what? I don't know. Huh? Yeah. Hey, it's the show. I'm Scott Horton. So I let myself get all distracted this morning. I guess I'm about to let it distract me again here now. Salon.com, they reran this article, as they do sometimes. And Salon.com, by the way, for those who aren't too familiar, that's the liberals. They linked to this thing from Alternet. They're a little bit further to the left there. And the thing at Alternet was, you know, evil corporate type scam things. I don't know. I forgot the exact title, but it was examples of evil corporate scams. And then somehow, in fact, even I guess Salon got the title right. But when they tweeted it out, they said, oh, let's see some libertarians rationalize this stuff. And every single thing in there was a thing that libertarians entirely oppose. Oh, privatizing prisons. Well, that's really bad because it gives these corporations incentive to have more prisoners and more and slave cheap labor, and ain't fair. And yeah, really, huh? What, have you been reading everything that libertarians have said about privatized prisons since any libertarian has ever written a single word about it? Because that's exactly the libertarian position. Is that the last thing in the world that you want to do is combine the state's monopoly right to arrest and imprison people with the profit motive of the contractors who have the right to hold the prison and hold the prisoners in it. That is the definition of fascism. And pardon me, liberals, for your little feelings and everything, but you are a hell of a lot more conservative on prisons than us libertarians are. Libertarians want to abolish prisons. Libertarians don't believe in government police forces and trials and prisons. We believe in a private property anarchy. We believe in restitution for victims. Not some ridiculous notion of popular sovereignty. Whoever heard of that? What a joke that is. Let's see, if I came up to you and I said, oh, popular sovereignty means everybody else said I get to boss you around, you would think that that was ridiculous, right? But for these institutions, the most corrupt and violent institutions on the face of the planet Earth, why, their legitimacy is just not in question. The only time that government locking up people by the millions is a problem is if some evil corporation makes some money on it, too. And, of course, this is a problem going all the way back, because if it's not Wackenhut and the private prison owners who lease out space to the government and that kind of thing, it's still the concrete manufacturers, the quarry works, the iron bar concerns. They lobby for drug wars, too. They lobby for more laws to imprison more people, too, because they are rent-seeking fascists, too. Now, to somehow put libertarians, of all people, on the side of the fascists is just lazy and stupid. How many Democratic governors and legislatures have signed into law these policies creating these so-called privatized prisons that still have the monopoly force of state law to back them up and to fill their coffers? It wasn't libertarians that did that, and it was never libertarians who promoted it either. And then they go on to toll roads. Oh, look at these toll roads where the state takes tax money and builds a giant freeway and then somehow gives the right to collect all the tolls to some private group of corrupt cronies that bought them off. Well, that's funny. Let's see, in the state where I think that this is the worst problem probably in the whole world, Texas, it's the libertarians who opposed it all along. It was the liberals and the Democrats who said, well, this is only fair and help fight pollution and blah, blah, blah with your crap. No, see, it's fascism when Rick Perry holds a gun to the head of every taxpayer in Texas and forces them to pay for a road and then rigs a deal where all the money collected from the tolls, which are collected at publicly run police department gunpoint, try not paying your toll and see what happens when the warrant comes out for your arrest. And takes all that money and gives it to his politically connected conservative corporate buddies. In this case, a Spanish company. And they might have been hired to, you know, help build a road or something, but it was Texas tax money that built the roads. 45 and 130 and all of this. And it's the libertarians who have opposed this system. It's the libertarians who prefer socialist roads to these kind of fascist roads, when what we want is actual privately owned roads, which is perfectly reasonable and acceptable. The problem is the state monopoly and the cronyism and the laws backed up with public violent force that make it this way. And how could a liberal be so blind? You know, I just don't get it. The guy who wrote the original article didn't say, oh, you libertarians have a lot to answer for, because no libertarians are implicated in any of the scams that he's talking about. But over at Salon.com, they see conservatism, and then they want to point their finger and blame you and blame me. But why? What's Salon.com so afraid of? Well, I already kind of revealed it, didn't I? They are way more conservative at Salon.com than libertarians are. We're the real radicals. We're the ones who are really opposed to injustice. What they are in favor of is the state. In fact, they're in favor of every state institution that exists in this country. And if there's a problem with any of them, they might need to be reformed a little bit. Would be the worst kind of critique that you would hear at Salon.com. Well, now that Glenn's gone. I don't know. You know what I think it is? I think they're terrified that the young people aren't believing in liberalism anymore because liberalism is a corrupt and bankrupt and illogical philosophy. How could you even explain liberalism to the young and expect them to buy into it when every bit of it is full of the most violent and ridiculous hypocrisies? Civil rights. Yeah, you're for civil rights and you're for those who violate people's rights the most at the same time.
You know, ask Chuck D. He'll tell you the federal government is the number one killer and destroyer of leaders of the weak and powerless in this society. And so young people are turned right on to libertarianism because libertarianism makes sense. Libertarianism stands as the direct antidote to the corruption and the bankruptcy of modern liberal and conservative, democratic and republican ideology and policy. And that's why Salon.com is always attacking libertarians who actually have no political power in America. Because we are undermining their support. We are attracting those who they believe belong to them, the young. But they're just wrong. They're completely wrong. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And another quick bit from Barack Obama's speech this morning. Early this afternoon at West Point, reaffirming American exceptionalism, the president said, "That's why we are putting in place new restrictions on how America, that is the U.S. government, collects and uses intelligence, because we will have fewer partners and be less effective if a perception takes hold that we are conducting surveillance against ordinary citizens." So, isn't that interesting? And now to introduce our next guest on the show, it's Nadia Kayali. I'm sorry, I should have asked how to pronounce your name correctly before bringing you on here. Welcome to the show, Nadia. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
And did I say it right?
Pretty close. It's Kayali.
Kayali. Okay, I'll put a line over the A so I remember for later. Okay. And of course the pen quits working on me right now. This great article that you have here, this is very important, everybody. I hope you'll go and find this. It's at EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation. I hope you'll go and do your part to make this viral. It's a very important piece, how the NSA is transforming law enforcement. And really great piece, really frightening piece here. And what you say here is, and you're referring to some of the new, I guess, documents that have been released over the last year, but also this new trove of documents that was released to coincide with the release of Glenn Greenwald's book, which was just published a couple weeks ago there. So, and then you say here, right here in paragraph one, that NSA surveillance has become a part of day-to-day law enforcement fabric, the day-to-day law enforcement fabric in the United States. Well, how's that possible? I thought they were just hunting for terrorists.
Well, you know, that is the common justification that we are given when the conversation turns to NSA surveillance, right? Constantly we're told that the degree of NSA surveillance that we are being subjected to is necessary to fight terrorism. But these new documents, as well as some other leaks, and really even just a close examination of statements of NSA officials themselves, makes it clear that it is not just about counterterrorism. It's about surveillance in general. And, I think it's something that everybody really needs to think about.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, I like the way you set it up, too, that if you've been imagining the NSA as, you know, something distant with analysts looking at this metadata and whatever, it does make it seem, I think you're right, you paint a great picture there, the false picture that everybody really does believe in is that, well, you know, maybe they really are collecting everything, but it's not like they're looking at my stuff, right?
Yeah, I think that's what a lot of people think. And, you know, it's understandable. We have heard so much about NSA surveillance, especially in the last year. And as you probably know, EFF has been doing this work since before the Snowden disclosures. But people have heard so much, I think it's easier to just think, well, that's something far away. It's something that doesn't affect me.
Right, because otherwise all the TV characters would be really concerned, and they don't seem to mind. So I guess it's all right. That's where I learned my consensus is the sitcom stars. what they're concerned with, you know, is what I'm concerned with. Well, and actually, you know what? It's stupid and silly, but I think that's actually really something, right? If all the fictional characters on TV just couldn't believe this NSA stuff and kept talking about it all the time or whatever, that would really matter. That would really move the American people, you know, 6 feet our way. But no. Anyway. Same thing for the Iraq War. They just never talk about it. They just pretend it's not part of the real world that we live in, the TV world that we watch. So now, okay, if I'm a cop, if I'm a Texas Ranger, or I'm a Department of Public Safety here in Texas, or I'm a Travis County Sheriff or something, what access do I have to NSA data?
Well, that is actually a really good question, and it's one that I'm hoping to do more investigation into, and, you know, we'll see what sort of disclosures we're going to be seeing in the next couple of months. But, you know, one of the things that we do know is that the NSA, there's been some court orders that have allowed the NSA to share unminimized data with different law enforcement agencies. So we know that the NSA can share unminimized data with the FBI, with the CIA. And we also know that the NSA can share unminimized data with the National Counterterrorism Center. So, you know, when people think of surveillance, they're thinking mostly of the NSA, maybe a little bit of the CIA and the FBI. But the fact is, there's actually a huge intelligence. It's actually called the intelligence community. It's 17 different agencies. And it turns out that there's actually a web of information sharing that allows this information eventually, potentially, to be filtered down to local law enforcement. And that's, you know, I didn't talk about it as much in this article, but a couple of months ago, I wrote an article about fusion centers. Now, you mentioned, you know, Travis County Sheriff, right? A local police officer. Mm-hmm. Those types of law enforcement do have access to fusion centers. That's the entire point of these fusion centers, that are connecting local law enforcement with federal law enforcement. So it is potential, and I'm not going to say that it's happening because we haven't seen the proof of that yet, but it is potential that unminimized NSA data, that's data that still has all of the personal identifying information, like your name, your social security, these things that can actually identify people, it's possible that law enforcement's getting access to that. And that's incredibly concerning. And it's something that hasn't been talked about enough.
Mm. Well, and it's the kind of thing where there are no real protections on the state law level in any of the 50 states about how that kind of stuff can be abused once it's handed over to them from the feds, because it's all brand new stuff, right? It's all making it up as they go along.
Well, you know, you're definitely correct that the legal protections vary incredibly from state to state, and that, you know, what happens is that it becomes this sort of jurisdictional nightmare where, you know, I'm here in California, and California is a good example. We do have constitutional privacy protections in the California state constitution. Here in San Francisco, we actually have we're one of the few cities that has specific protections on intelligence gathering, the way that the San Francisco Police Department can gather intelligence information. And yet, you know, if there's this data that is being filtered through these local federal collaborations, the fusion centers, we don't really know, you know, where what laws apply and how do they apply. And, you know, even more importantly than that, how do you enforce your rights? Especially if there's not a private right of action, you know, if you can't go to court and sue the government, or if you don't even know what information is being collected, which, you know, I think obviously that's a major concern. Mm-hmm. So you're right that it's a very confusing legal environment here when it comes to an individual like you or me trying to figure out and trying to protect our rights and our privacy.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you know, I mean, there's just this story that came out about how the Fusion Center in Boston was keeping their close eye on Occupy during the plotting of the Boston Marathon attack, because that's how they got their priorities set up. And to try to, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt, or, you know, to not be too harsh on them or the other cops in America, the truth of the matter is that there never really were more than a score of Al-Qaeda guys in the country in the first place. So they've got a whole, you know, terror war overseas, where actually Al-Qaeda works for America now in Syria and Libya. But anyway, well, in Syria anyway. But as far as here, there is no terrorism here. The closest thing you have to terrorism might be, you know, like white supremacists plotting abortion clinic bombings and stuff like that. But even that is so few and far between. Somebody like Tsarnaev
or Zazi, or any of the very few actual terrorists who've been recruited by Al-Qaeda or the Taliban to try to carry out attacks in this country have been so few, there's basically nothing for these cops to do all day but sit around trying to come up. And I'm trying to be fair to them, like, in, you know, put myself in their position. They don't really have anything else to do all day except make up broader definitions of terrorism. So maybe if there are some left-wing groups that, well, they don't seem to want to participate in the Democratic Party, they just want to occupy the city hall all day, maybe we can call that terrorism. It's not quite blowing up the Oklahoma building or anything, but it'll give our cops something to do between now and lunchtime, that kind of thing. And so they go, and now we got to take this break. But anyway, we'll get back to that on the other side of this break. Talking with Nadia Kaya, I don't have it in front of me, damn it. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Oy, finally. All right, y'all. Thanks for hanging on through the break. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And my apologies, Nadia, for getting your name wrong there on the way out to the break. I'm talking with Nadia Kayali from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF.org. And man, they do such great work there, especially if you're one of these millionaire types or something. Help support the EFF. We would be absolutely doomed without them. EFF.org. And they don't just do journalism. They sue the government all day for violating our rights and this kind of thing, too. They're absolutely an indispensable organization. And now, I'm sorry, Nadia, because I talked all the way up to that break, but I was going to try to get to a question there about whether you think that that's part of the problem here with the local police, you know, through the fusion centers and all of this, accessing all of this national government database and whatever. It's sort of the self-licking ice cream cone, as the soldiers call it, of just a program finding a reason to exist. And if there never were more than a couple of dozen Al-Qaeda guys in the country, then maybe we need to find some other terrorists around here.
Well, you know, I think it's certainly, as you were saying, sort of giving credit to these guys, I think it's important to keep in mind local law enforcement that, you know, they are, I think that they're well-intentioned, but that the fear of terrorism, it's such a visceral fear. And having seen things like the Boston bombing, you know, I think that that sort of well-intentioned desire to keep people safe, I think it has gone far above and beyond what it really should do. You know, we have so much information at this point that more intelligence gathering is not going to keep anybody safer, and it has become this sort of self-perpetuating cycle. And I think, you know, one of the really important things to keep in mind is all the federal money that goes into it. It's not just through fusion centers. There's also grants that are available to purchase drones, to purchase armored vehicles. There's these urban area security initiative grants that local law enforcement can get. And so it becomes this thing of everybody wants to get more technology. They want to be involved. They want to be doing something interesting. And it's all sort of based on this initial, well-founded desire to keep people safe. So I think it's a really dangerous combination, sort of some good intentions, some money thrown in there, some excitement. You know, it's sort of sexy work to be doing, to be fighting the terrorists. It's a really bad, really toxic combination. And it's led to these things like focusing on Occupy, which is just ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, I mean, terrorism has a specific definition. I know they don't like being very specific about it, but it means, a terrorist act is one that is targeted against civilians in order to provoke a reaction out of the government, in order to usually to try to get them to overreact and hurt themselves by overreacting, something like this. But anyway, it's violence directed against innocent people. for a political cause. And there just are not very many individuals. I think there are no groups in America who advocate any such thing, except maybe some neo-Nazis or something that nobody pays any attention to. But otherwise, you would have to be a guy like Faisal Shahzad, who was a happy American with a big house and a profession and a wife and a life, who went home to Pakistan and saw the aftermath of U.S. drone strikes on his family and home village back in Pakistan where he was from, to come back here and want to do something. Otherwise, line up all 300 million of us. None of us are terrorists. None of us. The whole thing is a scam, and you got every sheriff's department in America has got, like you're saying, they got a trunk full of M16s, they got an armored personnel carrier now, they got itchy trigger fingers, they're looking for somebody to do something. They better find somebody doing something and call that terrorism then, since there are no Al-Qaeda anywhere near here. They're all working for Obama in Syria right now.
You know, I certainly think the terrorist threat is overblown, and not only that, I think there are varying opinions on how big the terrorist threat is, right? I am of the opinion that it is incredibly minimal, as you are as well. And that, you know, that being said, we also have all the research and statements from various sources saying that actually NSA surveillance really isn't helping very much. We've heard this number that the bulk phone collection, that it's thwarted 54 terrorist attacks. Well, these claims have been debunked. There's been studies from the New America Foundation, the Privacy and Civil Liberties Oversight Board issued a report saying they haven't identified a single instance where bulk collection made a difference. We have senators saying that it's not making a difference. It's just, And I mean, we're talking about the NSA bulk surveillance of the phone records. But if that's not making a difference, you know, we're really not seeing a lot of examples of anything else making a huge difference either. There's just too much data out there. It's, I think it's really sad to see how people are just they're not using logic anymore.
Right.
They're just being driven by this primal fear, and it's really a problem.
Well, and on that Frontline episode a couple of weeks ago, they said the New York Times guys talked about their meeting in the White House where the NSA, I guess Hayden explained to them that, yeah, you know, we stopped a terrorist attack with this program. And they said, oh, yeah, what was that? And he said, yeah, the guy was going to collapse the Brooklyn Bridge with a blowtorch. And never mind the fact that that was an FBI put up entrapment job in the first place, but just the fact that anyone was ever going to take down the Brooklyn Bridge with a freaking blowtorch. And then the guy, I forget if it was the editor of the publisher of the New York Times, said he looked at the president and George W. Bush just smiled, like smirked at him, that I know it's ridiculous that that's the best excuse we got, but that'll be good enough for you. And then they agreed to keep
the story
secret.
I think that's a really important point, talking about the FBI's role in terrorist plots, that the there's a study, it's a couple years old, from the Brennan Center that's looking at the different terrorist plots that supposedly the FBI has foiled. And I think it's something like, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's something like out of 51 attacks that they looked at, maybe two of them weren't plots that involved entrapment from the FBI. I mean, the FBI has this huge role in, they're acting as, they're going in, they're going to communities, they're recruiting informants, and they are targeting consistently. They find people with mental health issues or people with criminal records or people who they can sort of bribe or scare into working for them. Mm-hmm. And they are, just like you said, they're creating the plots themselves. It's
invoking them as the reason that they need to spy on you and me.
Exactly.
Which is
exactly
great. By the way, Trevor Aronson, he did the real work on this. He wrote a book about it, and he catalogs, there's 200 and something terrorism convictions, but he says no less than 50 of them were outright entrapment jobs. And there are a lot of bogus terrorism cases, but 50 of them are, you know, the informant coming and saying, I'll give you $20,000 to say you love Osama into this hidden microphone, you idiot. And then the guy says, oh, yeah, I love Osama. And then he goes away for life. They frog march him on TV, make a big orange alert out of it, that kind of thing. And that's Trevor Aronson from the book is called The Terror Factory. And he also wrote up a great piece about it for Mother Jones Magazine as well. But anyway, yeah, no less than 50 of these are outright entrapment cases. You mentioned in your article here, and could you talk a little bit about this, the Special Operations Division of the DEA and the so-called parallel construction?
Yeah, so this is one of the more concerning things that's been happening with NSA surveillance, that these tips are getting passed to the DEA, and even the IRS actually is getting intelligence tips from the DEA's secret unit, right? And so when you think about the NSA, you don't think that that information would somehow be getting its way to prosecutors, but it is. And the really concerning thing is the source is getting cloaked. So the idea of parallel construction is that they're finding some other way to say that they got the information. They have some secret informant that they can't reveal the source to or something like that. So people don't actually ever even know that the information is coming from the NSA.
Otherwise, the exclusionary rule would kick in, right? The judge would have to say this evidence can't be used because it was obtained illegally in the trial, but they just lie.
Right. You know, I mean, it depends on what exactly the information is and how it was collected. But, you know, if it was collected by the NSA, we think, obviously, since we have lawsuits against the NSA, we think that there are concerns with the constitutionality of the information. But, you know, it is really turning the idea of being able to confront your accusers, the idea of how our criminal justice system works, it is really turning that idea on its head, and it's something that we're incredibly concerned about.
Yep. Well, you guys are doing the good fight there. I don't know. I'm certain we'd be much worse off without you. Thank you so much for your time on the show and for all the work that all you guys do there at EFF.
Thank you, and thanks for having me on.
Appreciate it. It's, Nadia Kayali at EFF.org, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, how the NSA is transforming law enforcement. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for OffNow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something important, something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And thanks very much to Dan, who just wrote a nice little thing about how much he likes the show and all that. That was cool. You can find it on my Twitter feed if you want to look at it. That sure is nice of you, Dan. God dang, man. Thank you. All right. Well, like I say, the great Will Grigg is going to be on the show tomorrow, and the great Brendan O'Neill is going to be on the show the day after that. And, oh, Nancy Youssef is going to be on the show either tomorrow or the next day. And so, yeah, stay tuned to the show the rest of the week. Well, the rest of this hour and the rest of the week. I'll do my best for you and see if I can put it together. You know, something good for you guys to listen to. So now, I don't know. I'd rather talk about Greenwald and Snowden than about Syria. Actually, maybe I'd rather talk about Syria than Greenwald and Snowden. I don't know. I guess I'll talk about Greenwald and Snowden a little bit. First of all, tonight, I'm not going to be able to watch it until late. I'll get home and watch the video. But tonight, Brian Williams is airing his video with his interview with Edward Snowden. This is the first time that this is the first time Ed has given a speech. God dang, I'm just going to start this segment all over again. I'm not a cool guy anymore, as if I ever was before. Okay, so, welcome back to the show. It's going to be a good show later in the week, even if not anymore today. Ed Snowden gave an interview to Brian Williams,
The first interview that he's given to a TV, cable TV news channel in the United States, or TV news channel in the United States this whole time, in the last year since the leaking of the documents to the great Glenn Greenwald. And now Brian Williams, maybe it was smart of him to choose Brian Williams to invite to do it, because one thing about Brian Williams is he's certainly a hack, but he is, I think, somewhat literate. So, you know, compared to a lot of these news anchors, I think it's possible that he could have some substance to what he says. At the same time, he's a ridiculously, horribly obvious Republican. And he always has been. And if you listen closely to, not even closely, if you listen with one ear to any time he's asking a serious question to somebody, trying to really follow up and get somebody on something, it's always a right-wing Republican talking point as the basis for his follow-up question. I don't even think it's supposed to be much of a mystery, just what a Republican Brian Williams is. Well, so I think maybe that's good, because what that means is he's going to really try to bring it. And maybe if someone, you know, was a little bit more reasonable, they wouldn't even try the false accusations that Brian Williams tries to get away with. And so my attitude is bring it, because I think Edward Snowden is perfectly capable of answering a question based on a falsehood with some truth and bat that thing right down. It's the same thing as Glenn Greenwald. You know, I don't think Edward Snowden is quite as well-spoken as Glenn, although he's pretty well-spoken. But Glenn Greenwald, I've been warning, especially mainstream media people, for the last year that you better be careful with this guy, because he will kick your sorry ass. He is so good at arguing. Even if he's wrong, he's still going to whoop you in an argument, and he ain't wrong. So you try to come at him with all these, you know, half-assed talking points, you better get ready, because he's going to make a damn fool of you. And remember the lady on the BBC, who she actually did the very best job of trying to nail Greenwald, and he absolutely obliterated her and probably her career after that. You cannot mess with that guy. And I already know that because I already know him and have talked to him for years, but of course, there's also that great debate that he had with the former drug czar at Cato, where for someone arguing on behalf of the war on drugs, this was as good as it could possibly get. I mean, this guy really had his act together. And I'm not saying that his conclusions necessarily followed his evidences, but he really had his evidences in line. And so Greenwald gave the opener, and then the drug war czar guy gave his refutation, and then Greenwald completely H-bombed the guy off the face of the earth. Are you kidding me? And in fact, I think this is a conversation Hornberger and I had once about this, was Hornberger said, yeah, and you can see where when the guy's talking, it was on C-SPAN, and when the drug war guy, the ex-drug czar, is talking, they clip back to Greenwald momentarily, and he's not taking notes or anything. He's just sitting there calmly staring straight ahead, and you can see him writing the article in response in his head the whole time that the guy's talking. And so then when it's his turn to talk again, all he has to do is just read the article he just wrote, revise it a little bit on the way out, but just excellent. They ever come and get me, if I get a writ of habeas corpus, I want Greenwald to be my litigator, man. He's a badass. So anyway, Snowden, I think, is also quite up to this challenge. And one of the promos that NBC has already put out is Snowden saying, I was a spy. You try to say I'm some low-level, you know, nobody. Well, Brian Williams said, oh, they all say that you're some low-level nobody. And he said, really? Well, and he answered that he was trained as a spy and that he did covert operations for the CIA. And that was, you know, pretending to be somebody he was not in order to, as he put it, something to the effect of make network systems work for the U.S. government. And, of course, he was stationed in Switzerland for a time. You know, so he said, oh, no, he was very high level. And in fact, and DIA confirmed this, he said he gave two or three, I think it was three, major speeches to the highest levels of the U.S. intelligence community about their computer security. Oh, Edward Snowden, he's a dropout. He's a loser. Blur, blur. Was that you repeating that? Like a minor bird, because that's what the conservatives told you to repeat. He's a dropout, I heard. Yeah, I know. If you Google Snowden dropout, you'll get 10 zillion results for Snowden dropout, because that was the orders from on high, how to smear this guy. Let's say he didn't finish high school. Ooh, you got him there. Here's what he did. He told Hayden and Alexander, here's how you do it, you idiots who don't know anything. Here's how you keep your computers secure. Here's how you're doing it wrong, and here's how you should be doing it instead, was the title of the speech he gave to the leaders of the DIA and the NSA. Oh, what a dropout. What a loser. What a scumbag. You know, I heard Edward Snowden was nothing but a janitor. Oh, I'm sorry. He was the most qualified computer genius on the whole damned campus. And you know what? Go read the thing in Forbes about him where somebody anonymously but confirmed by Andy Greenberg. And Andy Greenberg is a great journalist, by the way, there at Forbes magazine, Forbes Online. An NSA source came to approach Andy Greenberg and said, let me tell you all about the real Edward Snowden, okay? Because I know him, because I worked with him underground in the tunnel in Hawaii. And this is how he really is. And it's all awesome. It's all awesome. He was a genius among geniuses. He was more principled than any of us. If we ever had help, he would come and help. If there was ever a problem. Oh, and by the way, all those accusations that he stole passwords, not true. All those accusations, this, that, the other thing about him, not true. And ultimately believable, if you go and read. And that Andy Greenberg is no pushover. I am certain that he would have verified, and he says, and I trust him, that he verified who it was he was talking to. Even though he does not name the NSA source, it is clearly a co-worker, a colleague of Snowden's, not some superior sent to do a hatchet job, but someone talking on, and not someone, not his best friend, sent to protect him either, but just one of his colleagues saying, this is the real truth about the guy. Just like he says, he is a decent, honest computer genius working for the U.S. government. He came to understand that the NSA was absolutely out of control, outside the law, outside the Constitution, and that there was no accountability, and there was not to be any accountability. And so he did the right thing. He did the best thing he could have possibly done, and that is he dropped the line to Glenn Greenwald. That's Edward Snowden, the traitor. Top-level spy, gave speeches to the leaders of the DIA about how they should take care of their computer security. Yeah, what a dropout. What a loser. I heard the surge worked, and they really did find Saddam's weapons, too. Conservatives who think what you're told.
The military-industrial complex. The disastrous rise of misplaced power.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here. I'd like for you to read this book, The War State, by Michael Swanson. America's always gone to war a lot, though in older times it would disarm for a bit between each one. But in World War II, the U.S. built a military and intelligence apparatus so large, it ended up reducing the former constitutional government to an almost ceremonial role and converting our economy into an engine of destruction. In The War State, Michael Swanson does a great job telling the sordid history of the rise of this national security state, relying on important first-hand source material, but writing for you and me. Find out how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy all alternately empowered and fought to control this imperial beast, and how the USA has gotten to where it is today. Corrupt, bankrupt, soaked in blood, despised by the world. The War State by Michael Swanson. Available at Amazon.com and at Audible.com. Or just click the logo in the right-hand margin at ScottHorton.org.
We should take nothing for granted.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Now, I could continue on about Snowden and all the accusations that he's a spy and whatever. Again, there's a clip of him from the interview that's coming out tonight where he reminds Brian Williams that it was Barack Obama that left him stranded in Russia. He never meant to go to Russia. He was on his way to Cuba and then hopefully somewhere else in Latin America. He was pushing for asylum in Ecuador. It was Obama who left him stranded in Russia at, I think, great risk to himself. I mean, I guess the talking point went out to the Republicans that you are not to criticize Obama for this. But for me, if I was a conservative, this is the highest treason ever. Because, of course, conservatives love war, even if it's for Al-Qaeda in Syria. As long as it's war, conservatives love it. But how about leaving a guy with a brain full of knowledge like Snowden has and stranding him in Siberia? Exiling him to Russia. Russia! I mean, if I was a member of the Republican Party, or if I had a say in Republican Party spin or whatever, this would be the first article of impeachment against Barack Obama, that he stripped Edward Snowden of his passport while he was in Russia! Now, it makes great public relations, doesn't it, for the U.S. government? Oh, he's in Russia. I heard that he works for the Russians. I heard that somebody said that they think that maybe he works for the Russians. Remember this article in Time magazine? I imagine that probably what they might have done would be give him some pills and then interrogate him while he's on roofies. Remember that? They actually published that in Time magazine. Sometimes, you know, when I'm cleaning the wax out of my ears and I'm just kind of spacing out and making up stuff, I like to come up with scenarios wherein Edward Snowden might be guilty of treason. Here, publish this. And then they do. Time magazine. But anyway, it was the Democrats that left Snowden stranded in Russia. And again, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be so accusatory, because that's not a very good way to provoke, you know, self-reflection or whatever. But were you one of the people? Have you ever repeated the talking point that you think Russia and that Snowden was working for Russia? That he's a Russian spy? Because there's no evidence of that. There's no actual indication of that. All there are lies by horrible liars who would have you believe that. And if you are one of those people who has believed that, maybe you should ask yourself why you're so willing to bend right over and let your brain get raped by liars, by people who are beneath you. You're going to lay down and let them screw you right in the brain like that? These scum of the earth government bureaucrats and their allies in the media who would try to have you believe that this hero who was only trying to warn you is actually your enemy, that they are trying to protect you from him? Oh. Now listen, I know it can be really hard to admit that you've been wrong, especially when you've been that wrong, but you know what? Go ahead and let it sink in. Maybe think about it the day after tomorrow. Oh, that was me repeating that talking point, wasn't it? Believing my enemy as they smear my hero. Huh. Maybe there is something wrong with my brain, you might say. And this goes for conservatives and liberals, too. It wouldn't go for liberals at all, except Democrats are in power. Now, conservatives, it still goes for them because they love the state even more than liberals do. The very worst parts of it, especially. The mass murderers, the spires, the Bill of Rights destroyers, they love it. Even with Obama at the reins of it all, they love it. You're more likely to get liberals like our last guest, who's good even though Democrats are in power. Then you're likely to get conservatives who are good because they're in power. Never mind how evil all American conservatives are going to become again the moment that Jeb is sworn in. Oh, it says in the Bible you have to render unto Caesar, and that means no dissent against Republican presidents. Oh, they love the Constitution so much, except when Republicans are in power. And they love fiscal conservatism so much, except when Republicans are in power. And they love principle at all in any way whatsoever, except when Republicans are in power. Now, that's not really true. Conservatives mostly are still dedicated to their principles of hating Mexicans and hating blacks and hating gay people and hating women and hating everybody who's better than them. So those principles, they never give up. But the ones where they pretend to care at all about peace, freedom, honesty, all that goes right away as soon as a Bush is sworn in. Anyway, well, I heard Snowden might be working for the Russians. Yeah, great. Yeah, I heard that he exposed Tempora and XKeyscore and Prism and more. Yeah, it's all right there at EFF.org. At GlennGreenwald.net. I've got all the documents for you. All right, I wasn't going to talk about that. I was going to talk about Syria. So Liz Sly, I respect her. She writes for the Washington Post, but I respect her anyway. Oh, by the way, I want to do y'all's calls, too, if anybody wants to call in. I'm doing too many things at once here. The phone number is 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836. Talk about whatever you want. Ask a question, whatever you want. 512-271-4836. 48-36. And then I'll get back into Syria more on the other side of this break. But I just wanted to mention kind of the unreality of the debate about Syria this whole time in America still. And it's because of the influence of the state in the mainstream media, of course. But this morning, Chuck Todd and Liz Sly both made statements, and I'll be more specific here in a minute, but made statements that basically, and Chuck Todd is the complete ridiculous goofball at MSNBC, and Liz Sly is a real journalist based in Lebanon, writes for the Washington Post. But they both made these statements about the war in Syria and American support for the rebels in Syria that to me betray an absolute refusal to deal with the reality of that war there. And, you know, Chuck Todd actually was maybe more instructive because out of the mouths of babes and all that is, you know, he shouldn't have said anything. But what he said was, isn't it funny that Al-Qaeda in the Syria war, they're on the same side as us. But of course, it's America that's on their side. It's their war. It's not our war. It's a rebellion among the Islamists, among the Sunnis of Syria, and the Iraqis, and the Saudis, and the Lebanese, and the Egyptians, and the Libyans who have come to help them fight. So the al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. These are the Zarqawiites. These are the Bin Ladenites. It's their war. And Chuck Todd, he just can't do it. His brain just can't do it. Huh. Al-Qaeda is on the same side as us. We are on the same side as Al-Qaeda, Chuck. That's what's going on here, dude. Somebody get Chuck Todd a map of the Middle East and show him, I don't know, spots for Sunni and solid green for Shia, and explain to him that America started a Sunni-Shia civil war in Arabia, that geographical center, as Dick Cheney would call it, and that right now America is on the side of their enemies from the last war. It's as simple as that. It ain't Bin Laden's treason, his men's treason. It's the USA's treason on behalf of their enemies is what's really going on here. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. Yeah, sorry about these dang breaks interrupting all the time. The point about the Chuck Todd thing is, it's not that he's a bad person or a dishonest person, right? It's that his understanding of the world is an inch deep. And he's the TV hairdo who does the news. He's the actor who plays a news reporter. And, you know, he reminds me of a character out of a, he reminds me of a complaint of Neil Postman's, right, about, you know, mistaking data for knowledge, information for wisdom. You know, he's the kind of person who thinks that the truth can be found in hacking out the exact percentage points between the Republicans and the Democrats in this slightly Republican-leaning congressional district last time. That's what it's all about to him, right? Is the horse race in this local county commissioner's precinct freaking thing. And this is something I've noticed about TV news my whole life. My whole life it's been like this. Since I was a little kid, it's way worse now, don't get me wrong. They always talk about the who. Who's winning? Who gets to run the thing? Who gets to decide? But never what they decide. And in fact, not even what's different about them. What if I'm new around here? And I wanted somebody to explain to me, well, what is the West Bank anyway? They'll never say. What if I want them, in fact, go back to the horse race? What if it's between a Republican and a Democrat, or two Republicans in a primary for the Senate in Nebraska? Aren't you going to tell me what's different about them? You're only going to tell me what they said about each other. Oh, well, the one guy said this about the other guy, and then the other guy said this. That's not news, man. Tell me what's true about them. Well, this guy wants to murder 10 million Muslims. This guy wants to murder all Muslims. So you see, he's the more conservative one. Right, see, now my primary vote has been informed by your great journalism. But I could never get such a thing out of Chuck Todd. All I could ever get out of Chuck Todd is Dewhurst, thank goodness, lost to whoever the other guy is, who's probably worse, but still Dewhurst doesn't deserve power, and so screw him. So that's what he'll tell me. Dewhurst has been unelected, some other guy has been elected, but he'll never tell me about Dewhurst. He won't tell me that Dewhurst is a former CIA officer. He won't tell me that the reason all the conservatives hate him is because he didn't thwart that lady's abortion filibuster that she did, which is what they're all bent out of shape about. They won't tell us whether the new guy's good on guns or bad on guns or this, that, or the other thing. Just that it's no longer Dewhurst, now it's a different guy with a different name and his hair parts the other way. And that's it. And that's all you need to know. And the reason why is because that, honestly, is all that Chuck Todd needs to know. That's all he thinks you need to know. So he doesn't read about who's who and what's on the ground, what's going on the ground in Syria, who are which groups, what's the name of the group of the guy that, you know, ate the other guy's heart or lung or spleen or whatever it was live on camera. And what association does he have with John McCain or whatever it is? Right, he doesn't look at stuff like that. What's important to Chuck Todd is what is who saying about Libya. Congressional Republicans would like Barack Obama to do more in Libya. Obama says he wants to do more, but is somewhat limited, and so he can only do X instead of X plus 3. And this is the news from Libya. And so here we are, 3 years into this thing, and Chuck Todd does not know that it was in the New York Times. It's been in every major journalistic outlet in the world that American money and arms are going to the jihadists. Even David Sanger wrote a thing up like this in the New York Times. Even blogs of war, the very pro-war bloggers, had a thing. Remember Daniel McAdams linked to it about how the TOW missiles that they're only giving, these very sophisticated, wire-guided anti-tank missiles, they're only giving them to the very vetted rebels. No, wrong. The Islamic Front is the new name for the supposed softer jihadist who are just middlemen, who are best friends and really no different at all from the al-Nusra Front. Jabhat al-Nusra. And so now who has the TOW missiles? Al-Nusra has the TOW missiles. You know, al-Nusra, that has sworn their allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Oh, and by the way, so has the new head of the Islamic Front, which after the FSA, the so-called Free Syrian Army of, you know, bribed expats, none of whom actually are brave enough to get in a fight, all of them want to go home and collect CIA dollars the rest of their fat-ass life. Right, but they finally got chased right the hell out of Syria and into Turkey. So they said, well, now we're down to the Islamic State of Iraq and Jabhat al-Nusra. We need a new name for something. So they put together another coalition of some smaller militias and said, you guys are now the Islamic Front. And they said, okay. And then their leader, the same day or the next day, declared his loyalty and allegiance to the goals of Ayman al-Zawahiri, the leader of al-Qaeda, hiding in somebody's mom's basement in Pakistan somewhere. These are the guys who are getting the TOW missiles right now, Chuck. There are no moderate rebels, Chuck. And I know, you know, Lande said he saw some moderate rebels in northern Lebanon, not northern Lebanon, in northern Jordan, being trained for sending across the border, but very few. And they are certainly not the leaders of this war, and they have not been. This has been al-Nusra and ISIS's war all along. And Lande agreed with the conclusions, the assessment of David Enders from when he was actually on the ground reporting from Syria, that this is their war. This is al-Qaeda's war. In Iraq, as David Enders reported from Iraq at the time, al-Qaeda in Iraq was really only a very small part of the Sunni-based insurgency, which was led by all of the leaders of the Sunni tribes. and their religious leaders, their local imams and whatever, they supported this entire grassroots Sunni Arab uprising against the Americans virtually the whole time that they fought from 03 through 06. Or, well, yeah, through 06, and then, you know, the end of 06, the Americans finally stopped attacking them and accepted their offer to just fight al-Qaeda, take the money, and patrol their own neighborhoods for a little while, the so-called awakening, which, of course, did not lead to any real benchmarks being met or any real compromises between the Sunni and Shia there in Iraq, but still. The point being that al-Qaeda in Iraq during that whole insurgency, they were a small percentage of the insurgency. That was an Iraqi Sunni insurgency. But that is not the case here in Syria. In Syria, this is not a broad-based Sunni revolt. The Sunni Islamists are revolting, and they are a small percent. The people who are willing to actually do the fighting anyway, I don't know exactly what all percentage of the community, you know, support them in spirit, but the reason that the Sunnis are like 70% of Syria in population, the Sunni Arabs, but they're less than 50% in terms of the leaders of this fight are way less than 50% in terms of their support. And why is that? That's because everyone who's not a Sunni Arab in Syria supports Assad. The Kurds and the Shia, the Alawites, who they're sort of kind of a kind of Shiite, but not really. They actually predate Shiism. But anyway, the Alawites and the Shiites and all of the different Assyrian and Chaldean and whatever other kind of Christians you can name and whatever, they are all siding with the dictatorship, the secularist dictatorship, protecting them from the al-Nusra guys. And then approximately, you know, at least a major percentage of the Sunni Arabs agree with them and are not supporting this uprising because they don't want to live in an Islamist state, which is, of course, guaranteed to just provoke decades more civil war. And so they are at least de facto supporting Assad as well. So the parallel to Iraq just doesn't hold. In Syria, it has been al-Qaeda's war this whole time. Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Sham, they call it, or Syria. And this is who Chuck Todd is surprised that they're fighting on the same side as us, that the U.S. is supporting on their side. And that Liz Sly from the Washington Post was lamenting that we won't double down support for this. It makes no sense. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. Hilarious. Right now on MSNBC, they're attacking Edward Snowden. The liberals. Oh, he says it's wrong to spy on China. Oh, really, huh? I thought he said it was wrong to spy on Chinese civilians. Oh, well. MSNBC, they don't care what's true. We got a caller on the line. Anybody else wants to call in? We got one more segment here. I'm going to try to fit in everybody's calls. It's 512-271-4836. Caller on the line. Hang tight. I'll be right with you. I just got to cover a couple of things here real fast. First of all, I just have to say, because I forgot to say when I was ranting about Snowden and Greenwald, John Kerry today, and this is the 100th time I've heard this from 100 different people, said that, oh, well, Edward Snowden, if he's so great, then he needs to man up and come home and face the music and face accountability for what he's done. Well, that is absolutely dishonest. And here's why. He's charged under the Espionage Act and the whistleblower defense. I know I broke my secrecy agreement, Your Honor, but I only did it for the higher truthful calling of Thomas Jefferson's free market of information and ideas is not allowed as a defense. Right? They would no sooner allow him to say, but I'm a whistleblower, in his defense in court, than they would allow him to say, yeah, but Bob is Bob. And so that's why I ought to be, set free too. They will not let him make a whistleblower defense. Understand? He is forbidden from making a whistleblower defense. And that is why John Kerry is a horrible, evil, lying hypocrite. And that is why anyone who says, well, I think he should come home and take responsibility, ought to be smacked in the mouth. Responsibility? You mean life in prison without parole for being a hero? Maybe you should go and be locked in solitary the rest of your sorry life, since your life is so sorry. I hate people. I really do. Well, gee, Joey Reid on MSNBC told me I'm supposed to love the government and hate all the heroes who try to warn me about what the government is doing to me. And so I side with my oppressor and with Joey Reid against myself and my hero. And this goes for what? You know, some gigantic percentage of the American population, if not a majority. Make me sick. And then, and then the other thing is, I want to mention real quick on the Syria thing, that one of the things that Obama said today implied that maybe there was a redirection plan for Syria, that maybe this was now an anti-terrorism mission, that maybe now he'll admit, or I don't know, maybe he's just lying, he wants to double down support for Al-Qaeda and call it the war on Al-Qaeda or what, but they're talking again about opening up a third front, trying to train up an entire army of moderates to fight Al-Qaeda and the government in Syria. But the way he said, everybody was disappointed. All the pro-warmongers, including Liz Sly, were disappointed today that, oh, it didn't seem like he promised that much. But if you go and look at some of the debates, some of them were saying, actually, it looked like he was siding with Assad and saying that maybe... It seemed like maybe he was saying it's time to expand the drone war to attack the al-Nusra front and ISIS. They are bin Ladenite terrorists, after all. And so maybe this is they're turning right around in Syria. I mean, will the conservatives even and the liberals even notice? As long as bombs are going off, you guys are happy, right? Does it matter if we're fighting for or against the forces of Ayman al-Zawahiri? Anyway, I guess I wouldn't be surprised to see them go ahead and turn it into a drone war, an anti-Nusra Front drone war. Anyway. And then one more thing. And I'll get right to you, caller. And anybody can call and talk about whatever they want. We still got quite a few minutes here, 7-6 minutes. Guns. I'm sorry that some jerk killed a bunch of people. But I'm so sick and tired. I'm so beyond sick and tired of liberals pretending that every time that there's a newsworthy killing, that now they get to start their push to take everybody's guns away again. You don't get to. You're not going to get to. And the gun owners of America, which is more than half of the Americans, they are not going to have it. And in fact, they're getting angrier and angrier and angrier at those who would attempt to exploit senseless murders for their own political gain. And I'm sorry that, you know, this guy's son died and he's now coming out and leading the charge and blaming the whole thing on the NRA or something. Typical, ridiculous Hollywood liberal crap. You know who's responsible? The murderer. And anybody who watched the murderer's video or read the murderer's manifesto knows that he takes full responsibility for his own decision-making and his own actions. And now, it's unfortunate that we all didn't get to shoot him in the face. He only got to kill himself. So no real accountability. But he's the guy to blame, not guns. And a guy who's willing to go and mass murder strangers is not going to be deterred by your gun control laws any more than he's going to be deterred by your anti-murder statutes. And if you think that a kid can't get a gun on the black market in LA, pretend there's total gun control in the West. You can still get a gun. There are 300 million guns in America. They're not going away. And this psycho murderer would have murdered these people with guns anyway. The only thing gun control does is ensure that targets are helpless, on average. Not in my neighborhood. Somebody tries some stuff like that in my neighborhood, they'd be shot dead within the first minute. And by the way, in my neighborhood, and I'm from Austin, and it's a pretty liberal town, but it's in the middle of Texas. And when we're standing in line at the Quickie Mart, and the guy in front of us or behind us or next to us or whatever in line, and he has a gun, we're not afraid. We're not. I mean, we notice. But we don't get all boo-hoo like a damn liberal Democrat. In fact, even the liberal Democrats among us, they don't get all boo-hoo. If anything, they feel reassured that the guy in line has a gun. Nobody better try and rob this place. It's good people carry guns around here. Good people who kill bad people. Who try it. And no, I'm not saying every college student must be armed. Or anything like that. But they have the right to be. Everyone has a right to defend their life. And the fact that we have a higher murder rate in America is beside the point. The truth of the matter is, everywhere else in the world, humans do not have the right to defend their own lives with lethal force the way Americans do. And if you go beyond all the scare headlines of people trying to take your rights away, and you just try for a moment to look, you will see a million times a year or so, hundreds and hundreds, literally, I mean this, liberals, really, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of times a year, decent, honest, law-abiding people brandish and or use firearms to stop and or deter crime. No, you are not about to rob this Quickie Mart. No, you are not about to rape me. No, you are not about to get away with this, that, or the other thing. There was one just last week where some guys were trying to abduct this woman and force her to take money out of the ATM until somebody else in the parking lot had a gun. And said, oh, really? More like, start kissing the pavement or I'll blow your head off. And then the cops came and arrested them and took them to jail. That just happened the other day. And there's a million of them like that. It happens all the time. And so, I don't know. Just expect that you're going to fail. And just accept that you are going to turn the gun owners of America against you more and more and more and more every time you try to exploit a murder for your political goals of disarming your political opponents, which is what civilian disarmament is really all about. It can't work. Find a new issue. I know Democrats are in power, so you don't want to cry about the wars, liberals. Maybe you can go boo-hoo-hoo about the trees some more. While Barack Obama slaughters people all day with, you know, guns and bombs. All right. Sorry, caller. Man, thanks for holding on for so long. You are on the air.
Hey, I haven't heard the whole show, so maybe you Zoe! Have already addressed this issue.
Hey, look, yeah, hey, everybody, it's Zoe. How's it going, man?
Yeah, good to talk to you. Glenn Greenwald is talking about how he's going to release the names of the people that the NSA spied on. But I'm looking around on the internet and I can't find like when he's going to release it or if he said, if he's given a time or
sure.
Do you know anything about that?
I sure do. I'll answer it right here too. The thing of it is this. Where did he originally say this? Oh, it was a interview in GQ. So Glenn Greenwald, GQ, pull that up. And then secondly, he elaborated for a piece in the Sunday Times in London, but it was which you can't read without paying them, but it is at Real Clear Politics. They reran the whole thing at Real Clear Politics. And yes, he has said that's going to be the final story. The big 4th of July fireworks finale is going to be who all they've been spying on. And God, I hope it's congressmen and senators and governors and people with power, corporate CEOs and stuff. Let's have a fight. See y'all tomorrow.